I imagine Windsor is not too dissimilar to Guildford. I was doing some research recently in Guildford. I asked a member of our youth group what it's like being a Christian in their school. They told me there are 500 people, pupils, in their school, and only around 3 go to the Christian Union and identify as Christian believers. That's about 0.6%. I was chatting to a student at the University of Surrey in Guildford, and apparently there are 15,000 students at the university. Around 70 go to the Christian Union. That's 0.5%. I was talking to somebody else who works in the City of London, and in this person's firm there are 400 people in their firm, and he doesn't know of any other Christian. That's 0.2%. Now, I'm aware that's not sort of exact science, that's not an exact study, but for most of us, if we're Christian believers, we'll be in a small minority most of the time. I don't know how many people live in Windsor and how many meet in this fellowship, but most of the time we'll be in a small minority. And we might wonder why, if Jesus is such good news, and he is, why doesn't everyone believe in him? Why aren't there thousands of people here in Windsor Fellowship listening to the Bible about Jesus? Well, why doesn't everyone believe in Jesus is a question the reader of John's Gospel may well ask at the end of chapter 8. Because Jesus has done some amazing things. He's healed incurable illness, fed huge crowds, he's walked on water. He's done some amazing things, and he's made some incredible promises. He'd said back in chapter 5 that anyone who believes in him will go cross over from death to life. He'd said chapter 8, verse 12, he promises to take people from darkness to light. Chapter 8, verse 12, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. He's done some amazing things, made some incredible promises. And yet, since chapter 5 of John's Gospel, the response to him has been a mixture of rejection, desertion, confusion, and outright aggression. And so at the end of chapter 8, if you look up, people pick up stones to try and kill the one who offers life. Why doesn't everyone believe in Jesus? But another question the reader of John may well be asking at the end of chapter 8 is, how can anyone believe in Jesus? In chapter 8, Jesus described the Jews to whom he was speaking at the time as walking in darkness, slaves of sin, and children of Satan. Can you believe it? That's what Jesus said. He'd said to the Jews to whom he was speaking, look, you haven't listened to Moses, you don't actually belong to Abraham, and you're not really honouring God. And here's the thing, if those people to whom Jesus was speaking, with all their blessings, with all their privileges, if those people don't believe, well, what hope is there for anyone? Why doesn't everyone believe? And how can anyone believe? Those are the questions posed by chapters 1 to 8 of John's Gospel and answered in chapter 9. Because in chapter 9 that we're looking at this afternoon, John shows us that Jesus, as Jesus, the light of the world, shines, some are made to see and others are made blind. That's the big thing that John shows us in these verses. Jesus reminds his listeners in verse 5 of chapter 9 of what he'd said back in chapter 8, verse 12. I am the light of the world. And what does the light of the world do? Well, amongst other things, chapter 9, verse 39. For judgment I have come into this world. So the light has come, and the light brings judgment. So that, verse 39, the blind will see, and those who see will become blind. So in the same way that the sun both melts ice and hardens clay, Jesus' light gives sight to some and causes blindness for others. Chapter 9 is the second of Jesus' Sabbath healings. In chapter 5, if you were here for that, he healed a lame man on the Sabbath. Here he healed a blind man on the Sabbath. And the key to understanding what's going on in this chapter is to realise that the healing of the blind man is a physical picture of a spiritual work. In other words, Jesus opening this man's eyes to see physically is a sign pointing to the great work that he's come to do. That is opening people's eyes spiritually so that they can see who he is, believe in him, and have life in his name. It's a brilliant chapter. It's a slightly unusual chapter. Jesus performs a miracle at the start. He explains the miracle at the end. And for 27 verses in the middle, Jesus is absent. We don't hear from Jesus for 27 verses in the middle. But through a series of interviews between the Pharisees, the man, his neighbours and his parents, the writer John shows us that even though Jesus isn't actually around, he's not even there, he's still continuing to do his work of giving sight to some, the blind man, and causing blindness for others, the Pharisees. And that's a work that Jesus is continuing to do today. That's why not everyone does believe, because he causes blindness for some. It's why anyone can believe, because he gives sight to some. We're going to think about those two things in turn. First of all, Jesus' light gives sight to some. As he was going along, Jesus saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, verse 2, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" In their minds, as in many people's minds, there is a direct link between personal sin and physical suffering. It's a view not unlike held by Glenn Hoddle, who used to manage the England men's football team. He expressed in 1999, or at least he was quoted as saying, that people who suffered with disability in this life was because of a sin or sins in a previous life. Now, there are occasions, of course, where there is a link between physical suffering and personal sin. So the person who loses self-control, has too much to drink, gets behind the wheel of a car and crashes it into a lamppost, causing the loss of sight in one eye. In that case, of course, there is a connection between physical suffering and personal sin. But according to verse 3, there's no automatic connection between sin and suffering. Jesus has no place for the sort of Hindu idea of karma. And so when we just, this is slightly on the side, but when we speak to those who suffer, which may well be frequently, we do need to be very careful to avoid jumping to the conclusion that they are suffering because they are sinning. They might be, but they may well not be. For Job in the Bible, for Jesus, and the man born blind in chapter 9, there was certainly no direct link between personal sin and physical suffering. Verse 3, Jesus says, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus. "But this happened," in other words, the blindness happened, "so that the works of God might be displayed in him." Now, this is amazing. Jesus is saying there is a reason why this man was born blind. It's not because of his sin. It's so that God's work of opening blind eyes might be shown in him and through him. And that's the work that Jesus has come to do, opening the eyes of the blind, physically, here, spiritually, always. Verse 4, "As long as it's day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work." It's a slightly confusing verse. I think by night, Jesus is referring to the period of time between his arrest and his death. That's night. John describes it in chapter 12 as night time. By day, there in verse 4, I think Jesus is talking about the time up to his arrest and after his resurrection. Because the work of opening blind eyes is what Jesus is doing now, there in chapter 9. It's what he would go on doing through his disciples after his death and resurrection. And that's the work, of course, Jesus continues to do today through his word and by his spirit. And that work is shown physically in verse 6. After saying this, he spat on the ground, made some mud with the saliva and put it on the man's eyes. Go, he said, wash in the pool of Siloam. This word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. So in verse 7, Jesus has given the man born blind physical sight. But he can't yet see spiritually. And so from verse 8 to verse 38, John shows us how this man's spiritual sight is gradually corrected. I went to the opticians recently, and I had to do that thing where you put your chin on the rest. I'm always so nervous. I think they're going to poke something in right in my eye. But I put my chin on the rest, and they said, look at the letters. What do the letters say? I could barely see anything. And then they put another thing in front of my eyes, and I could just make out some things. They were quite blurry. I thought one letter was at a H. And anyway, they put another one, and I could see clearly. I could see that what I thought was an H was actually an N. It's always best to guess, isn't it? It's always best to have a little stab in the dark. Now, that trip to the opticians is a little bit like what's going on here for this blind man spiritually. So he starts off in a complete blur about Jesus. He then gets to see a little bit more clearly. But by verse 38, he has 20/20 vision. Because what he initially saw to be a man, he comes to see at the end as his Lord. Let's have a look at that. He starts off spiritually blurry. Verse 11. His neighbours ask him how his eyes were opened. And he replied, verse 11, the man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and then I could see. So he knows Jesus' name, the man they called Jesus. He knows he's a man, but he doesn't know much else. He's looking at the letters on the board, and it's just a bit of a blur. I mean, he doesn't even know where Jesus is from. But then his spiritual sight starts to get a bit clearer. Verse 17, he's taken to the Pharisees, who question him about the healing. Verse 17, they say, what have you to say about him? It was your eyes he opened. The man replied, he's a prophet. Interesting. So he's gone from calling Jesus a man to identifying him as a prophet. See, he's looking at the letters and they get a little bit clearer. It gets clearer still, verse 33. He gets called back in to the Jewish council for a second round of questioning by the Pharisees in verse 24, who claim to know that Jesus is a sinner, yet they don't know where he's from. And so the man says, verse 30, now that is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God doesn't listen to sinners. He listens to the godly person who does his will. Nobody's ever heard of opening the eyes of the man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. Interesting again. He no longer is Jesus just a man, but nor is he now just a prophet. He's come from God, says the man. From blurry to clearer to perfect 20/20 spiritual vision in verse 38. This man gets thrown out of the synagogue for siding with Jesus. And so Jesus finds him and asks in verse 35, do you believe in the Son of Man? Who is he, sir? Tell me so that I may believe in him. Jesus said, you've now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you. The man said, Lord, I believed, but I believe. And he worshipped him. So Jesus performs a miracle at the start of the chapter. At the start of the chapter, he gave the man physical sight. But at the end of the chapter, he gives him spiritual sight. Because that is the work that Jesus came to do. For the last four chapters of John's Gospel, from chapter 5, it's as if people have responded to Jesus as if they're blind, spiritually blind. There was massive confusion in chapter 7. There's rank hostility in chapter 8. And the first person to see Jesus for who he really is a man who was blind from birth. Isn't it typical of how God works? The religious leaders, with all their religious privilege, could not see who was standing right in front of them speaking to them. The man blind from birth recognized Jesus as Lord and treated him accordingly, worshipped him. See, this man really is the model believer. He's humble and he's worshipful. And notice, he believes despite opposition from the authorities. They kick him out of the synagogue. But he sides with Jesus and he worships Jesus. He's the model believer. He'd moved from darkness to light because Jesus' light gives sight to some. And that's what Jesus does today. If you're a Christian sitting in the room, it's only because Jesus' light has shone into your heart and flicked the light switch on. About 15 years ago, I led a church youth group, and there was a young guy in the group who's looked for all the world to be a strong Christian believer. He was about 16, head boy in his school, Christian family. We met up for coffee in a coffee shop one lunchtime at his school, and he said, "Lydia, I've got to tell you, I'm not a Christian. Everyone thinks I'm a Christian. I'm not a Christian. It's killing me because everyone expects me to live like this and do this and believe this and say this. I just don't. I've got all these questions." And he came up with about 15,000 questions, and I had no idea. There we go again. I have no idea what I'm doing most of the time. No idea how to answer these questions. I said, "Why don't we just meet up once a week and look at the Bible together?" We went through Colossians. It's amazing. After 2 weeks, his questions changed from mild hostility to genuine hunger. After about 4 weeks, he started reading the Bible on his own, outside of our little one-to-one meetings. After 2 months, he met up with me and said, "Lydia, I thought you'd want to know I'd become a Christian." Excuse me, I'll break up into tears. I shouldn't have told the story. I don't know how it happened or when it happened, but it happened, and it happened as we just looked at the Bible together, and the Spirit flicked the switch on in his heart, and he moved from darkness to light. And he's done that for many in this room. You can say with the man in verse 25, with John Newton, I think this came before the hymn, "Amazing Grace." "I was blind, but now I see." So how can anyone believe? As you look out at Windsor, as you look at your family, your friends, your work colleagues, your neighbours, so hostile or so apathetic. Well, anyone can believe because Jesus' light gives sight to some. But that's not all we see in the chapter. There are actually two parts to Jesus' work. Because whilst Jesus' light gives sight to some, secondly, more briefly, Jesus' light causes blindness for others. Have a look at verse 39 again. "For judgment I've come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." Now, the blind seeing is shown in the man born blind. The seeing becoming blind is shown in the Pharisees, who've got none of the physical problems experienced by the blind man. Physically, they can see okay, but spiritually, they're blind. And John shows us that throughout the chapter. First, have a look at verse 16, where their conclusion to Jesus healing this man born blind is to say of Jesus, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." See, they don't believe Jesus' authority, and nor, ironically, do they believe the man's story. Verse 18, they still did not believe that he'd been born blind and had received his sight. until they sent for the man's parents. So this man comes and says, Jesus healed me. They go, you couldn't have been born blind. Get his parents in, they'll confirm it for us. So the parents confirm that their son was born blind, but strikingly, the parents refuse to get drawn on how he was healed. They say, verse 22, ask him for yourself. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders who, here we go, had already decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. That's a telling couple of words, isn't it? They had already decided. It's like the team of researchers who presented their findings to the manager. The research showed that the company needed to change policy and direction, but the stubborn manager responded by saying, my mind is made up, please don't confuse me with the facts. Lots of people think like that, don't they, in business, family life, church life, when it comes to Christianity. Look, I've already decided, don't confuse me with Bible stories. See, the Pharisees aren't interested in the facts. They're not interested in the evidence. They've already decided. And you may have met people like this. Striking. At the same time I was reading the Bible with that young guy, I was also meeting up with an older guy who claimed to be interested in the Christian faith. We met up pretty much weekly for about 6 months so he could ask his questions. I came to the conclusion he wasn't really interested at all. Whenever I said, do you want to look at the Bible, he didn't want to know. Whenever I said, can we talk about Jesus, he didn't want to talk about Jesus. He just wanted to sort of debate, argue the sort of toss. Not really, no humility, no hunger there. He'd already decided. Talking to a student at King's recently, went up to somebody and they were having a conversation. The student said, what do you think of Jesus? The guy said he didn't exist. The student said, well, have you ever looked into the Bible to see what it has to say about Jesus? No, never looked into it. Would you like to? We could meet up and look at it together. I'm not interested. Already decided. See, the Pharisees weren't interested, and their stubborn rejection actually turns into open hostility. Verse 28, they hurled insults at this man and said, you are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from. Striking, over the last few chapters of John's Gospel, we find out that the Pharisees actually don't know quite a lot. So they don't know who Jesus is. They don't know where he comes from. They don't know where Jesus is going. They don't know what he's saying. But they do know, apparently, that he's a sinner. And they do know, apparently, that Jesus is not the Messiah. See, they think they can see, but they're completely blind. Verse 40, some Pharisees who were with him heard him saying this and asked, what? Are we blind too? Jesus said, if you were blind, you'd not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim that you can see, your guilt remains. In other words, the blind know they can't see and they need to be healed. The seeing think they can see, and so they don't think they need help. Now, the Pharisees are absolutely responsible for their stubborn rejection and open hostility. They're responsible for their blindness. But Jesus is showing in this chapter that Jesus' light does two things, not one. His light gives sight to some and causes blindness to others. As Paul says elsewhere, people stumble over the capstone, Jesus. Now that means the qualification required for sight to be given is a recognition of blindness. The qualification for rejecting Jesus is to think you can see. Well, if you're a Christian believer, as I finish, can I say to you, praise God that you can see. You might want to see a bit more clearly, but if you can see that Jesus is Lord and you worship him, that is primarily because he's flicked the light switch on in your heart. Praise God. And keep prayerfully pointing people to this Jesus, to this light. If you're not a Christian listening to this, maybe you're here. It's brilliant you're here if you're not a Christian. Really good thing to come to church. Can I say, if you're not a Christian, keep hearing the Bible taught. Keep looking at this Jesus. Because there is nothing better than receiving the light that Jesus' light brings. Jesus' light gives sight to some. That's how anyone can believe. But Jesus' light also gives blindness to others. That's why not everyone believes.